from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll explore why unaddressed economic inequalities has led to support for Donald Trump. Then we'll learn about an event that helps survivors of sexual trauma express themselves and share their stories through art.
It's just so hopeful. The process just brings me a lot of hope. And I think that's what we need. We need that hope. We need that shared humanity that I think this brings to light.
Plus, we'll learn what Milwaukee is made of.
If you go on to the Pfister Hotel, you'll see that a lot of the blocks of the Wauwatosa Dolostone are what are known as rock face. They have all these kind of rugged projections sticking out in the middle, and then they're beveled around the edges.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. John Austin, an economist who focuses on the Great Lakes region, recently wrote an opinion piece for The Hill about former president and Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump's appeal to Midwest voters. Austin says it comes down to economic inequalities. He joins WUWM's Chuck Quirnbach to explain why Trump appeals to those who feel left behind.
There's yawning, you know, economic geographic divides. You know, parts of my state in Michigan, as Wisconsin, see communities like Flint and Saginaw and Jackson and Adrian that were once thriving manufacturing hubs that are now hollowed out. And we have to nurture together the conditions that create a new economic opportunity in those communities. And we have seen that it can be done. Obviously, every university town like Madison is thriving economically. But as you know, some of the communities in Wisconsin, as in Michigan, that have regional universities and have rebooted their economy are moving ahead. Those are places that people are more optimistic about the future. And so we need to organize at all levels, state, federal, and local, to support kind of affirmative policy and practical solutions that support community leaders to run a strategy for how they can reestablish an economic positive directional for your community. I'm very, you know, familiar with my home state, a little bit familiar with Wisconsin. And, you know, when you see a Western Michigan that lost a lot of manufacturing jobs, but is now growing again and dynamic, you know, folks are voting very differently than in the hollowed out communities that have lost their anchor employers and haven't found a future.
Those areas that are still suffering, you're suggesting that helps Republican candidate Donald Trump make his pitch?
It's very clear. I mean, we've looked at every election since 2016. It was the communities that are in relative decline, meaning they're losing population, their communities, you know, housing stock and other things are degraded, they're losing good paying jobs. Those communities are the ones that moved from Obama voters, you know, working class whites, to support a Trump. And they've been, if your community remains in decline, whatever county you're in, if you remain in decline and you feel, residents feel that their community ain't what it should be, then those communities have, in our region, have gone Trumpier every election since 2018, 2020, 2022 in the congressional race. Whereas it, communities that turn an economic corner, that are growing in population, that are seeing the creation of new, more diverse jobs and industry, those folks are voting very differently. And they're voting, I would say, on the issues. You know, are you doing something for me to provide health care? Are you doing something for me to create an environment where we keep our young people and attracting and create good new jobs?
Trump in Wisconsin has been blaming illegal immigration, immigrants, he says, taking U.S. jobs. It's a very controversial point. What do you know of the data as to how accurate that is?
It's totally wrong, meaning immigrants are a source of community repopulation and economic renewal. They create more jobs as the very entrepreneurial immigrant populations in many of our Midwestern communities are responsible disproportionately for small business creation and putting other people to work. But this this really opens the window on these sort of communities, yeah, that are suffering, rural communities that are feeling left behind, residents of older factory towns that haven't seen good jobs replace the ones that were lost through, you know, tremendous economic restructuring. Those communities that are experiencing this kind of feeling of being ignored, left behind, not having, being anxious about their own kids' future, their future economically, there's two types of political messages that can be sent and are being sent to these communities. Two different kinds of populism. Say, I see you, I see why you're feeling anxious and frustrated. You are right to be, you know, ticked off about the condition of your community and the opportunities for you and your kids and your family. One is the, here and in Europe and all these other countries, there's a kind of solutions-oriented populism. Think about what Tim Walz talks about, you know, struggling rural communities. Thank God for the GI Bill. Thank God for survivors' benefits. We're going to deliver childcare and a healthy meal for all your kids in school. That's a solutions-oriented populism. The right-wing populists, they blame somebody else. But immigrants create economic growth, economic development, population growth in Midwest communities, which sorely need it. So if anything, we need to welcome more immigrants, and many Midwestern communities are, for economic development, straight, you know, job creation, new businesses, rehabilitate neighborhoods. We're seeing it all across the Midwest, and many community leaders get it, and they want more immigrants.
Well, John Austin, another tool for economic development. The Democrats say President Biden has been visiting the state, Vice President Kamala Harris, Tim Walz, all touting things like the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the CHIPS and Science Act as making investments. What do you think of those big three laws now as to their ability to address some of these inequalities?
They're terrific, and they're exactly the recipe for success, economic success and regeneration in these communities, but in the long term. I mean, we in this nation, unlike Germany and some other countries, which have a long tradition of sort of looking at regions within their country that are struggling economically and amassing sort of national investment in those regions and their people. We don't have much of a tradition of doing that in this country, with two exceptions, the New Deal, the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority under Roosevelt, which was about a whole regional economic development effort, and the Appalachian Regional Commission during the War on Poverty. Until just recently, those laws and investment bills, the CHIPS Act, the Science Act, the Infrastructure Bill, the COVID relief funding, that has been disproportionately and purposely targeted at the heartland, at regions in our country that aren't the innovation hubs of the coast. And so, you know, rebuilding our infrastructures, which we sorely need, creating new innovation and startup ecosystems for the emerging technologies and jobs of the future in our great universities across the Midwest, that's what is beginning to happen. The problem is those things do take some time to nurture, you know, put people to work, except for some of the construction projects. But ultimately, they're going to provide a fabric of economic activity in our region that will, I think, cool the worries of people in the region about where's the future? Do I have a future? Is there going to be a good job for me? So ultimately, I think it will heal our politics, but it's not going to happen this year.
Can what's happening in other countries be a roadmap for the U.S., or is each situation different?
Each situation is a little different, though there's a common sort of thread. This was the year of elections, 2024, where 64 nations and half the world's populations was going to the polls. And, you know, the big question was, would democracy prevail, or would authoritarians and nationalists and right-wing populists carry the day? And it's been kind of a draw, but within all the countries that have voted, it's largely a function of this economic divide, closing the gap between the haves and have-nots and the parts of the country that are, you know, doing well versus and delivering for the, or better for the parts of the country that aren't doing well. So, for example, in India, you know, you had a authoritarian strongman in Modi trying to consolidate his power, but they checked his power through the polls because he wasn't delivering. There's a growing divide between the have and have-nots. The UK is probably the most interesting because you have, you know, 14 years of conservative governments that were just economically not delivering the goods for Britain. So what happened was in the northern struggling, you know, manufacturing belt of England that kind of turned Brexit and turned the last elections, folks threw out the conservatives in favor of Labour, but they also, in those same regions, they voted for the right-wing nationalist anti-immigrant parties in greater numbers, because you had, and so it's sort of an illustration of these two populist paths delivering for people that aren't feeling it. One is delivering like a solution, but equally attractive to many of those same residents in struggling communities is the uber nationalist, blame immigrants, right-wing variant. But in all these countries around the world, you see, like in France, the ultra-nationalist right-wing parties getting their support from left-behind rural and their Rust Belt regions of France, growing in by East Germany, just went through two elections where the kind of feeling ignored, feeling left behind, East German provinces of Saxony and Thuringia went right-wing AfD, almost Nazi party nationalists. So people respond differently to versions of populism, but they're actually voting their economic, like, sort of anxieties at the polls.
So to sum up for the U.S., put the crystal ball in front of you. How does it all play out if Trump wins in November, and how does it play out if Harris wins?
Well, I think if Trump wins, you'll see a walk away from what are the real solutions. Like, you know, let's accelerate our efforts to lead the EV and coming green revolution in this country, where the businesses and jobs of the future are going to be. You'll see the abandonment of all these place-based geographic heartland Midwest-focused investment tranches that the Biden administration, in a bipartisan way with Congress, made happen. So you'll basically see a rhetorical but hollow agenda that won't deliver better livelihoods for people in our part of the world. I think if Harris wins, you know, obviously there's an opportunity to continue and build on some of these innovation and economic development and infrastructure building investments and people investments in our region that ultimately will help us move from, and more of our region move from, in decline, losing population to growing again and having communities that are thriving and vital and that are places everybody, including our kids, want to stay and live and work.
John Austin is a senior fellow with the Eisenhower Institute at Gettysburg College, as well as the Brookings Institution. He spoke with WUWM's Chuck Quernbach. Lotus Legal Clinic is a nonprofit that offers services to survivors of sexual violence and human trafficking. They do this mainly through legal support, but they also do it through art. Lotus's annual Rise and Thrive Artist Residency pairs up a group of survivors with a local artist to help share their experiences in the aftermath of sexual trauma. This year, singer-songwriter Chris Porterfield and his band Field Report took the poems from five survivors and created an album. It'll debut at a benefit concert this Thursday at the Cooperage in Milwaukee. Ahead of that, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Porterfield and Erica Petty, Lotus's executive director.
So, Erica, let's start with you. Can you give us a brief overview of what Lotus is and who you serve?
So, Lotus Legal Clinic is a nonprofit, first and foremost. So, we receive all of our support through foundations, grants, and donors. We provide free services, free legal services and support services for survivors of sexual violence and human trafficking. Included in human trafficking is labor trafficking. So, and sometimes people, I think that's kind of the bigger misconceptions about our work, is that we also provide services for people that have experienced labor trafficking.
Now, given that most people don't become aware of these issues until someone they know is affected or perhaps themselves, can you give us a little insight about the scope of how these things impact Milwaukee or the Milwaukee area?
One of the things that impact the city itself the most is just the prevalence of people's untold stories of sexual violence. And that, I think, is at Lotus is something that we try and uplift, is that many people experience things of violence and this type of trauma in silos and alone. And one of the things that we hope to do in our community is provide support for people that have experienced this type of sexual violence and trauma. And one of the ways we do that and try to do that is walk with people when they are seeking legal services or seeking protection through restraining orders, or when their perpetrators are being, you know, criminally prosecuted, having an attorney on their side representing their rights as victims.
So as you mentioned, as a nonprofit, you need to rely on a lot of different methodology for funding. And one of those is the Victims of Crime Act, or VOCA. Mm-hmm. It's a common pathway to federal grants for organizations like Lotus. But funding has been shrinking for this over the last few years. Why? Can you share a little context?
So VOCA is funneled to the states by the federal government. And one of the big buckets for that funding is through actual federal criminal cases, white collar crime cases, and some of the money that is recovered from those cases. And so that pocket, to my understanding, has been shrinking over time. And there hasn't been any replacement or ways to figure out where else could the federal government get money to replenish that VOCA bucket on the federal level. And states have been affected differently. Some states have had larger buckets when this was all starting to dwindle. So we're all kind of nationally on different trajectories of where our VOCA funding is. And unfortunately, specific to Wisconsin, what happened was, I think all of the organizations that were funded by VOCA knew that there was going to be a reduction. Our understanding of that was about going to be around 15% to 20%. It ended up being actually like 41%. And so that really hit all of us in Wisconsin pretty hard. And the state DOJ had to figure out, okay, how do we deal with this? How do we let organizations know? And then how do we set up a procedure and to fund what we can?
Given that you need to kind of keep doing the shuffle, right?
Yeah.
How do you foresee this impacting the services you provide? Ideally, you want to keep it the same, but I imagine burnout is a big factor, staff retention, limited capacity, and then trying to fundraise and replace all these, you know, tens of thousands of dollars you rely on. That's a really hard task.
Yeah, it is. It is a hard task, but I think it's not unusual. I mean, this is part of
the nonprofit dance.
Nonprofit grind. It really is, and I think that is what you burn out on, is that piece of it. I think the burnout comes from knowing that there's always going to be an end of funding, and so then what's your next step?
Yeah, so. But for the time being, you feel okay.
I feel okay. Yeah, good. We definitely are going to be reducing some of our work, specifically with the therapeutic arts programming that was 100% funded by VOCA. So we are definitely going to be pulling back in the next year on some of that programming while we look for more funding based on like art and wellness grants and things like that. And so we have some exciting collaborations that are in the works. It's just we had to totally readjust that and think about how we're going to continue to fund this important work with Lotus.
And part of your operations is, of course, community support and artist support. And we're coming up on your annual Rise and Thrive event, where survivor writers are given the opportunity to collaborate with local artists. And Chris Porterfield, this is where we bring you in. Can you share your initial thoughts when you were asked to lend your voice and music to this project?
Yeah. So Lotus reached out to me spring of last year to see if I would be interested in collaborating with five of their graduates of the writer's workshop and sort of reimagining and responding to some of the work that they generated in that workshop. Yeah, I was delighted to be invited, and I was really excited to get started on it. And so I started my tenure as the artist in residence in April. Yeah, and so five of these writers submitted some work for me to look at and consider and ponder and dive into. And so for the first several weeks, that's what I did. I just read it and absorbed it and spoke it and hand wrote it and tried to internalize it. and understand it. And then I got to meet with them individually, get to know them as people a little bit, and some of the things about their stories and experiences and music that they like and movies that they like, and just get to know them as people. And then the resulting work is an EP that I did with my band Field Report, and we're releasing that as a fundraiser for Lotus, and then also going to be performing that music on the 12th of September.
Throughout this collaborative process with the writers, is there any moment or interaction that sticks out to you that you'd like to share? Or, you know, perhaps a line in one of their poems that you were reading, even on your own, where you're like, okay, this is a project unlike anything I've done.
I mean, honestly, all of it was just all stunners. It was just such an honor to be able to collaborate in this way. I've done co-writing stuff before with other people, but it's always, you're in the room sort of bouncing ideas off of each other. And this is the first time where there was a finished piece that I was asked to work with. And it's almost like these writers were the novelists and I was adapting it for screen or something, you know? But you really want to honor the spirit of the initial work. And so there are things that I never would have come up with if I was just, you know, creating from myself and the universe. Mm-hmm. But being able to respond and mold some of these things, a lot of the lines are just theirs, you know, and I was just organizing them and presenting them in more of a song format.
Yeah, and in your EP, let's talk about one track in particular. They're all really great, but the one called Caught Me Off Guard really stands out. And a lot of these have kind of their own arcs and stories within themselves. But can you share a little bit of behind-the-scenes insight to Caught Me Off Guard?
Yeah, sure. So that one, the original author came to the United States from Puerto Rico and didn't speak English when she arrived here. And one of the ways that she learned English was through the music of ABBA. It doesn't really sound like ABBA, but that was sort of in the background of how I wanted to make sure to present that work. Just little nods, some chord choices, some subtle production things. ABBA is their own sort of singular entity, and nobody can really do them but them. But that was sort of in the spirit of that, that track came around.
I like that. Let's take a listen.
I was ravaging for memory that I had buried mindlessly somewhere nearby when you silently caught me off guard. You caught me off.
With honoring, like you said, original completed pieces and having that different than your daily songwriting for yourself or for your band, what was it like to present the final tracks to the Survivor writers? Have they heard it yet?
Yeah, they have. And this was, it wasn't done until it was done sort of thing. And so we had a big meeting and I really was bummed out that I couldn't present the work without them having to use their imagination a little bit, but they were all very supportive and excited, and some of them shared privately that they were moved by the experience.
And Erica, for you, you've kind of overseen various Rise and Thrive iterations with different mediums of art. What does it mean to you to always see these projects come to fruition and have them be so original and unique every time?
I'm floored every time. It is just a beautiful thing to be able to witness and to support, and Chris's work this year and listening to how he talks about his collaboration with the writers, the way that they work together, the way he brings his beautiful talent to to the work, and being able to just create that sacred space too is just so important, and the trust that's built and developed. To me, it's just so hopeful. The process just brings me a lot of hope. And I think in many times in our days, like, that's what we need, is like, we need that hope. We need that shared humanity that I think this brings to light in some ways, because it's the sharing, it's the vulnerability that people bring to this work. And I can't say enough about this project, and also with each of the writers themselves and what they bring to it, and the vulnerability, that's a lot of it. You know, they have so much strength and courage to be able to not only share very intimate writings with someone, but then to have that trust. And Chris just did a wonderful, wonderful job, and I think he's an awesome human being.
Well, all the tracks on the EP are great, and people can listen to them and see them perform live at the upcoming Rise and Thrive concert. But for today, thank you, Chris and Erica, for joining me on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How blind could I be to not see the patterns closing in on me? I was hiding in the shadows when you showed up unexpectedly. You caught me off guard.
Chris Porterfield is the singer of Milwaukee band Field Report. Erica Petty is the executive director of the Lotus Legal Clinic. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. The Rise and Thrive concert fundraiser is this Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Cooperage in Milwaukee. You can find more information at WUWM.com. If you or someone you know is experiencing human trafficking or abuse, you can call 888-373-7888 for help. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about the Milwaukee Bears, a short-lived team that was part of Negro League Baseball. But first, we'll tell you about Wauwatosa Dolostone, a material found in Wisconsin buildings, including the Pfister Hotel. That's coming up next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. What Milwaukee is Made Of is our new series that's exploring the geological origins of Milwaukee's building materials. How many million years ago did they form? Where in the world have they been? And what brought them to Milwaukee? This debut episode focuses on Wauwatosa Dolostone, sometimes referred to as Wauwatosa Limestone, or Milwaukee County Limestone. As the name suggests, the stone was quarried locally and was used in buildings across Wisconsin, including in the Pfister Hotel in downtown Milwaukee. But that's only the most recent part of the stone's history. Geologist Raymond Wiggers is the author of Milwaukee in Stone and Clay. He joins Lake Effect's Sam Woods to discuss the Wauwatosa Dolostone's origin story and its journey to Milwaukee.
When and where was the Wauwatosa Dolostone originally formed?
It was formed in a period known as the Silurian period, which was about 425 million years ago. And at that point, keep in mind that this is a locally formed Milwaukee County stone. But in those days, Milwaukee County and the rest of the upper Midwest was located about 30 degrees south, not north, but south of the equator, roughly where southern Brazil or northern Chile is today. So since that time, North America has certainly traveled a lot. But the environment in which this stone formed was actually at the bottom of a fairly shallow subtropical sea. Lots of sunlight, dry air, but the sea was teeming with life. In fact, this was the time of the first great coral reefs. You know, these are the ancestors of the modern coral reefs you find in various warm waters of the world today. And so it was a wonderful, very diverse ecosystem. And amidst all the reefs and between the reefs, this material was filtering down to the bottom of the sea to actually form the stone.
How exactly was the rock formed? Was it sudden, like a volcanic eruption, or more of a slow process over time?
The rock first formed as sediments that actually precipitated at the bottom of the sea in this beautiful, clear, well-sunlit water. And the sediments were probably originally limey sediments. So imagine how, if you have lime mud, if you've ever been to the Caribbean or to the Bahamas, and you walk out from the beach, there's this wonderful layer of sort of white or gray-colored mud at the bottom of the water there. That's how this rock originally was settled down. And then eventually it probably began as limestone, and then at some point in its formation, it actually was chemically transformed into dolostone, which means it had additional magnesium added to it. So it started as a mud at the bottom. When we think of mud, we think of something kind of yucky and messy. This was actually pretty clean-looking stuff. And it's very, very characteristic of subtropical islands and things like that.
You mentioned that when the Wauwatosa Dolostone was originally formed, the land that we now call Milwaukee was located where the middle of South America is today. Did the stone travel in a straight line to present-day Milwaukee, or did it take more of a circuitous route?
I would say that it was primarily a rather circuitous course. First of all, one of the things that's happened is that in the time since that rock formed, the supercontinent of Pangaea formed long after the rock first came into being, and then it broke apart, and North America has been moving both west and north and probably in other directions too at various times in that long span of time.
So this is a rock that is older than Pangaea and came up in a tropical environment. Does that have any effect on the characteristics of the stone today?
In a sense, it does. Actually, it was subtropical, which is different, a different climatic zone. If you'd like to know what Milwaukee in those days looked like, the best thing that you could do is travel to the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Gulf, that area. So on land, it would have been a very dry, hot, desert environment, and the sea itself would have been very clear, fairly shallow, and it would have been absolutely teeming with life, with coral reefs, just as you see in the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Gulf now.
How long did it take for the stone to emerge out of the water where it began?
Well, it may have emerged at least temporarily at times when sea level went down a little bit, even back in the Silurian or soon thereafter. But the main thing is that it was subsequently covered by lots of layers of younger rock, which eventually were eroded away. However, in terms of the Silurian rock, the Wauwatosa Dolostone being at the surface, it probably wasn't until quite recently after the Ice Age, when especially streams like the Menominee River actually cut down through all the glacial material and exposed that rock at the surface. That's how we knew how to quarry it, because it was actually visible on the river bluffs.
If I was transported back 400 million years ago watching this stone form, what would I have seen? For example, would the mud that became the Dolostone be a similar color to what I see today at the Pfister?
The Dolostone is a kind of a rock known as a sedimentary rock. So it forms from these mud sediments, and one layer after another gets laid down. It settles down to the bottom of the water. You see this in Wisconsin ponds and in, you know, slow places and rivers. You'll see the sediment, whether it's mud or sand, settle down to the bottom, and then that layer forms. And then there's another layer that later forms on top of it, and then another layer on top of that. And eventually, the lower layers, the term the geologist uses, they get lithified, they get turned to stone. And originally, probably those lower layers that were turning to rock while the upper ones were still soft sediments, they were probably limestone, which means calcium carbonate. And then what happened was, over the course of time, they actually had another mineral, dolomite, which replaced the calcite. So it became a rock that was rich in both calcium and magnesium.
So now getting to the human history of Wauwatosa Dolostone, how did it end up in buildings all around the city and state of Wisconsin?
Well, it's very common as a community or a city begins to grow that it looks around for suitable building materials, not only clay for brick, but also if it has any bedrock in the area, it likes to exploit that. And it so happened that pretty early in Milwaukee's history, not super early, but pretty early, the bedrock was discovered and it started to be quarried. And one of the earliest, if not the earliest quarries in the Wauwatosa was done by the Story Brothers, who were located in what is now Milwaukee, but was then originally Wauwatosa. And their quarry was located, if we're familiar with the American Family Field, like parking lot complex, the northernmost parking area, farthest away from the stadium. That was where the Story Quarry was. And that is now officially part of Milwaukee, but originally it was in Wauwatosa. And they started marketing the stone for building stone and other uses too. And it caught on very quickly.
Did this stone have any type of advantage or appeal other than it was close and plentiful?
It sure did. First of all, it was a good dimension stone, which means you can cut it. So when you take it out of the head wall of the quarry, you can actually cut it into rectangular blocks and you can actually fashion it. And also, being a hard stone, dolomite or dolostone is usually a very hard rock. What you can do is, if you're a mason, you can chisel it or shape it the way you want to. If you go onto the Pfister Hotel, you'll see that a lot of the blocks of the Wauwatosa dolostone are what are known as rock face. They have all these kind of rugged projections sticking out in the middle, and then they're beveled around the edges. Masons can do things like that for decorative effect. So this was a very good carving stone and all that. And also it held up quite well. There are some stones that are more enduring, but you weigh that against the fact that this rock was local, and so it was less expensive to produce and to transport.
So obviously the stone has changed maybe in appearance or shape after construction in buildings like the Pfister Hotel or Eaton Chapel in Beloit College. But does being quarried change the effects of the stone at all? Like, does it maybe exposure to air or anything like that change the color or appearance of this stone as you might see it in nature?
Yes, it sure can. In fact, just to broaden the viewpoint a little bit, the Wauwatosa dolostone and the Silurian dolostone in the Milwaukee County area is actually part of a huge area that goes all the way from the lower part of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan all the way down south of Chicago to about Kankakee. In this area, you have this regional Silurian dolostone the whole way. And so the Wauwatosa is just our local version of it. And some of that stone, depending on where it's quarried, weathers more than others. And what weathering means is when you take the rock out of the earth's crust, out of the quarry, and you plunk it onto a building and it's exposed at least on one face to all the precipitation and humidity and urban air pollution and everything else, what you get, you do get chemical and physical changes in the stone. And that's one of the things that architects have to worry about is, will this stone fall apart soon after I put the building up, or whether it will be enduring and all that. And Wauwatosa dolostone is actually, in my experience anyway, it actually endures better than a lot of the other regional Silurian dolostones, for example, the stuff that was quarried down south of Chicago. It does tend to turn color as it ages, which is actually a plus. Depending on what building you're looking at, you'll see that the stone has turned from its original pale bluish gray to a kind of warm, buttery yellow. And you see that more in some buildings than in others, but I think that's a real ornamental plus. It really is a wonderful color.
Do you think we knew that before we started using it, or just?
I don't think so. I don't think people knew what they were using it to begin with, and that was just something that became apparent. You know, there have been other building stones that have been used elsewhere in the country that look really beautiful and wonderful and strong and enduring, and you put them up and they start falling apart almost immediately. This was a nice change instead of a bad change.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Ray, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. It's been great, Sam.
Raymond Wiggers is a geologist and the author of Milwaukee in Stone and Clay. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods for our series, What Milwaukee is Made Of. Coming up, we'll learn about The League, a documentary all about the history of the Negro Baseball League. That's coming up next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I am a rock, I am an island.
Thank you.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Are you familiar with the Milwaukee Bears? They were a Negro National League team that only played for one baseball season in 1923. Although their tenure here was short, they are part of a longer historic legacy. The Negro League was a stage for some of the world's best athletes and served as an important economic and social pillar for Black communities around the country. A documentary called The League dives into the triumphs and challenges of the Negro League through the first half of the 20th century. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by producer Byron Motley and executive producer Josh Green to learn about the film.
This film is dedicated to Bob Motley, who was a Negro Leagues umpire and co-author of the book, The Negro Baseball Leagues. Byron, you of course wrote this book along with your father, Bob. Can you share a bit more about your intimate connection with this project and how it came to life on screen?
Well, it's been a labor of love the last 24 years I've worked on this project. So I started working on this project 24 years ago, doing interviews with former players and the last living umpire, of course, my father, and just kind of piecing the story together as best I could from the stories I got from all these great men and women who were part of the history of the leagues. But I loved hearing my father's stories about the experiences had with Satchel and Buck O'Neill and some of these great athletes. So I grew up around that history. The older I got, the more I thought about it and really appreciated the stories, is that not everybody knows these stories, which got me thinking there's probably more to this story than what I've even heard from him. So that's kind of how this process began.
So this documentary covers a wide span of baseball history, starting after the Civil War up to the 1950s, to show, most importantly, that Black players have always been a part of and central to baseball. The tone is joyous, it's celebratory, and I imagine it was made with the same sense. Can you share what you all felt was most important, or perhaps what was your personal guiding mission that helped you with the editorial process?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think everybody had a passion for the story, for the subjects, for getting this out to the world. And this particular movie, in all honesty, there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen, which happens on movies. You need a lot of people to do a lot of different things. But I think the spirit of, again, and the passion of the stories themselves, of the characters, of what we knew there was a bigger mission there. And I think we all did our best to work together to make the best movie that we could make. And the guiding spirit really drove all of us that this was something bigger than any of us, and that we were doing Bob Motley justice, and we had to do the Negro Leagues justice because we knew how important it was. So I think that drove us to really put our heads together and do the hard work and get to where we got. So it wasn't easy, but we made it.
Yeah, I think it was just to really tell as much of the story as possible, because there's so many stories in the Negro Leagues about the Negro Leagues, because we only hit the tip of the iceberg for all the other stories that are woven in this incredible history. That was the idea, the concept for me from the very beginning, was to tell as much of the story as possible so that people can be inspired by and be excited about, and then go out and read more and learn more about this history.
With any sports documentary, and I think you guys do this really well, it's easy to focus on only what happens on the diamond, the players, the internal ecosystem. But what the league explores really well is the whole ecosystem that the Negro League impacts. And I think it's very important to explain for anyone who will be seeing this soon and learning more that you especially take care to note that a successful Black baseball team meant that there was often a successful Black community built around it in all the cities that the league was in.
Absolutely. Well, it had to have that community to make it a success. And at the time, baseball was king. Everybody in the country, I think, loved baseball. If you didn't like baseball, you respected it because you knew what it meant to other people. So the Black community was no different than that. And like I said, it was just heaven, as my father would say, to be at a Negro League baseball game, because everybody was dressed to the nines, everybody was looking good and ready to have a good time. And they would come out for a doubleheader. And want to say for a triple header, if there was one playing, you know, they just loved that game. It was like great fun for everybody. Just fun. And that's the one thing I kept talking to the team about, is that we need to, for this documentary, to show the fun, because that's what Negro League baseball was all about.
Yeah, and I think it was, just to add on, I agreed. That was a huge part of what, you know, Byron wanted to convey. And because this obviously, as you know, you could have, and we dealt with, it's a serious topic, American history and what segregation and, you know, all these things were very, you know, lynchings and, you know, it's very intense what happened to these neighborhoods. So it could have been a dark movie. And I think Byron was always the balance of saying, yes, we have to present, you know, how baseball history mirrors American history and how, what the obstacles were to, you know, to that business, to building that. And it shows how incredible it was that they built that business despite all those obstacles. I mean, third largest, you know, Black enterprise, you know, incredible communities that were doing very, very well because of the Negro Leagues. And I think, you know, but it was also important to balance it with, you know, the challenges and the tragedies and the, you know, the gravitas of that time period and what these players went through, you know, to play four games in a day or whatever it was, and to do it with a smile on their face, you know, because, it, as we say in the movie, it wasn't about the money or getting famous. It was, I mean, they wanted to play ball, you know. Yeah. So it's just a big testament to everybody involved in the Negro Leagues. And I think, you know, the other part for me was that what blew me away was that, you know, like, I think everybody just assumed integration was just 1,000% positive, you know, and I think that was a big part of why everybody kind of got on this train of like, I didn't know there were all these negative repercussions of that still exist today. Mm-hmm. So some of those communities that never recovered once those Negro League teams shut down and integration happened, it still has gone on today. And we say that briefly in the movie, in a sentence, in New York, in big cities, in New York, in Chicago and Philly. So I think it's those repercussions have lasted to today. You know, integration wasn't perfect. A lot of people got hurt.
Even in Milwaukee, I'm sure.
Milwaukee, absolutely. I'm sure.
I've been there a couple of times, but you take a drive around the streets and you drive through the Black neighborhood, and you'll see these dilapidated buildings are still there. Been there for 40, 50, 60, 70 years. Why is that? You know, it's still there. You see it everywhere. And there's no sense for that. It makes no sense. Why isn't somebody putting money into that and making it rebuild and regain its energy? Just some things just haven't changed.
For both of you, after having spent so much time on this project, what's the enduring importance of the Negro Leagues for you that you hope audiences will take away?
Keep the spirit alive. Keep learning about it yourself. Never let it end. There's so much great history. It's up to all of us. It's up to all of us to keep the spirit alive. That's what Buck O'Neill told me during the first interview I did with him. He said, it's up to you. You're doing this. It's up to you to tell the story and do it, and do it the right way.
I think for me, it's the game today is played because of the Negro Leagues and the style of play and the what the players created, what the people like Rube Foster and the managers and executives created, this style of game, that is what is played today. So the impact on the game itself that the Negro Leagues had, and, you know, we didn't really even mention this in the movie, but the Negro Leagues players played in Asia. They were brought over to Japan to play. So, you know, the impact of even on baseball globally by the Negro Leagues, you can't calculate. I mean, they might be the reason baseball's so big in Asia right now.
No doubt.
Yeah, not to mention the impact on having Latina players
Latin America
in the game, which is huge now. That was not allowed back then. So I think it's the impact on the game, but I also think it's just I think it's like Byron said, it's all about the truth and understanding history for what it was, understanding, you know, the important people, you know, that impacted history, and getting it accurate, and not only conveying the fun, of course, of all of it, and the fact that under incredibly difficult circumstances, the Black community built this incredible business that changed the world, but I think it's getting history right. And we're living in an age where, you know, facts are debated now, and history mm-hmm. books are being, you know, things are left out and rewritten, and depending on politics and whatever. And to me, it's like this story needed to be presented factually and as authentically and honestly as possible. And that's super important to me, that people know our real history. And I hope people take that away from it.
Byron Motley is a producer, and Josh Green is an executive producer of The League. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last year. You can stream the film on Hulu or Disney+. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Earlier this summer, there was a lot of buzz around the periodical emergence of cicadas. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll bring you the sounds and experiences the cicadas brought to Wisconsin. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.